The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Very full day, and I think one of the last things in my mind was giving a talk. So I think it would be a good occasion for me to respond to questions or topics that some of you might have. I like doing it because it's nice to hear from you all a little bit what concerns you have and kind of, you know, be more relevant to what might be of interest than just making it up on my own. So, does anybody have any questions or something they'd like to ask or bring up? And if you do, it'd be nice if you said your name first.
Hi.
Name?
I'm Eric. And my question is, I'm really calm. I enjoy coming here and sitting.
Uh-huh.
I have a very difficult time being as calm in the day.
Mm.
And I wondered if you could fix that for me.
How would it benefit you to be calm during the day?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
How would it benefit you to be calm during the day?
Well, I'd be happy.
Is that easy?
Is it easy?
Is it that easy to be happy?
To be calm. Well, when I'm here, when I'm calm, I'm happy. Yes.
Great.
But with some responsibilities, it's a bit of a trick.
Hmm. So there's many things to say. One of them is that is to use calm as a reference point to understand how you get caught up in the busyness of life or the responsibilities of life. And so it works a little bit better if you do maybe in the morning before going to work and starting your day. But you come to some modicum of calm, and then be very careful as you kind of start your day, start your activity, to notice when you start losing it. And as soon as you start losing it, stop, sit down, and take a good look at what just happened. Look at what you got pulled into, what you got interested in, what beliefs were operating, what emotions got triggered, what desires and fears got triggered. And right there, that interface between a time of being calm and a time of losing calm, there's a lot that goes on. And if you can become wise and understanding about what happens there, then you might discover that maybe you can, you don't have to get hooked in so quickly, because you understand the forces of being hooked in. You understand the beliefs, the ideas, and all that's going on, and you can question it. And you can have that wonderful question: is it worth sacrificing your calm for whatever you're losing it for? And if it is worth it, then lose it. But if it's not worth it, then maybe, you know, it's a poor investment. And I think that what people will find, that a good majority of the reasons they lose their calm is not, or their ease, or their peace, or their happiness, is usually not for very good reason. And to question it, to understand it, to engage in it, to grapple with it, to debate with it, is a very rich way, become a very valuable way of becoming wise about how all this works. Because we don't want to just have a pill that makes us calm. You know, just like we go through life just kind of like, you know, on a pill or whatever, you know. We want to really understand and learn about our lives and how it makes us tick, how this operates. But getting calm is a wonderful way to begin understanding more deeply what's going on for you. So the purpose of calm is greater understanding. The purpose of calm is not to be calm. What do you think of that? You're taking notes, so I guess that worked.
It sounds good.
Yeah. It's easy to be a teacher. What's difficult is to apply the teachings. So my job is easy. You have the hard part. Thank you. I appreciated the question. Can you pass the mic over to the front?
Hi. Can you hear me?
I think so.
Okay. I'm Mare.
I can't hear, though. Maybe it's not on. Green lights, are we on?
Hello? Talk louder. Oh, there we go, huh? Ice cream cone.
There we go.
I'm Mare, and there was a time that I spoke to you before about having a more deluded mind and making decisions, and you suggested make a decision and go with it, and rather than, because I spoke about how my mind just wants to, you know, him and haw over decisions, and I was wondering if we could talk a little bit more again about decisions when there's an abundance of opportunities, and maybe it feels like it's hard to settle on a decision to make. Like the mind is just kind of, you know, like it's coming from a place of anxiety and not wisdom. So maybe just decision making and wisdom and wise.
Have you ever made a decision in your life that was really clear and obvious or true and you felt this was really right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you know that? How did you come to that decision? What were the process of coming to that decision? Can you turn up a little louder?
Oh, but I was being
quiet.
A little
bit louder.
I wasn't talking.
It's a slider. The volume is a slider. Oh, okay.
Mm. I can talk louder.
My hearing's a little bit hard, so.
Is this louder? I can talk louder. I think, I mean, sometimes there feels like a calling and it feels clear, and then there's other times that it just feels like it's not as clear. Do you know?
Mm. But right? There are times when it has been clear.
Yes.
So what you just told me was very vague.
Mm-hmm.
Just a calling. And so. So I wonder if it would be helpful for you to find an answer to your question. It's a great question.
Mm.
If you could begin investigating those times when you had a clear answer, a clear decision you really knew, because just say it was a calling, some intuition, I just kind of knew. That's certainly true, but maybe it doesn't really speak to what's really going on deep inside of you.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, because we're multifaceted. There's many different elements going on within us. There's you know, beliefs and thoughts and desires and intuitions and body sensations and memories and you know, all kinds of things that go on. And so all those might come together in different ways in different times. So if you can tease it apart a little bit to get behind the word calling, you might start getting an answer to your question.
Mm.
How does that seem to you?
Yes, it seems true. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're willing here now, but could you go a little bit behind the idea of a curtain for us? I mean, a calling? How do you know?
I mean, I think when it feels like a important opportunity of learning and growth, like when I trust that there's a widening and an expansiveness, an opportunity for expansiveness that feels like it's in alignment.
Great, that's nice. So
does that feel less vague?
You know, that's great. So a decision for you was clear had something to do with the vision you had of the consequences.
Mm.
You had some sense of in the future you were going to be more open, more clear, you're going to grow in it.
Right. And if it's with a teacher I trust, that often makes it a lot easier.
So if a teacher helps you make the decision?
Yes, the people involved in the event or the opportunity.
So it helps you to have community around you, help you make the decisions. Mm-hmm. That's an element too.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. That's important to know that for yourself. Maybe that's part of your process is to be in communication with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And And then what about what it feels like in your heart or in your body when you make a clear decision?
Like joy in their heart, and like if there's an affection toward the person or the people involved.
That's great. So I'd encourage you to study this process of decision. You know, what really goes on? And you can do the same kind of deep study of when you're uncertain of what to do. To understand yourself better, what are the emotions, what are the fears, what are the beliefs that are operating, what's absent, what are some of the elements that you might need to help support you to make a decision that that maybe is not you find valuable but are not present for you, and then maybe you can bring them in.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Anna. My question is, I think when I first came to meditation, it was like during very challenging, difficult times in my life. And now that I'm thinking about it, I think there might have been some kind of aspect of escape in the meditation. I really had a lot of discipline to sit all the time and to come here and to come listen to a lot of Dharma talks. But it helped me a lot, and I'm really seeing the fruits of the practice along the way. But I feel like now that maybe life circumstances are getting better and I'm not in those challenging times as much, it's a lot harder to maintain the sitting practice. Mm-hmm. Even though I feel like I'm maybe in daily life, I still have the awareness and I still am... The practice is working for me, but I'm not as disciplined about the sitting or even going to hear talks or be. And I feel like there's some disconnect. Like I need to have more of that.
Well, I'm glad your life is better. That's nice, and maybe the meditation helped. And you called it maybe an escape, but sometimes we need to take a real break and step out of our normal life to kind of. Relax, get settled, clear out, take a vacation, get a different perspective of ourselves. It's a very important part to do that. Since maybe that's what you got, and that you benefited from it. And now your life has shifted, and so the motivation for meditation is going to be different. Mm. And sometimes it's a lot harder to be motivated when we're not clearly and obviously suffering in a way that we're struggling, we're trying just to cope. And so it requires maybe a different kind of reflection, maybe listening to some deeper voice inside. And so it might be a kind of time for deep reflection and looking at your priorities, looking at what's most important for you. And it becomes a little more abstract, maybe, in the sense that rather than coping with the immediacy of difficulty now, it's maybe having some deeper listening intuition to a potential, a possibility. The potential for a happier life, potential for a fuller life or a freer life, that your life's okay, but you know that there's something much deeper and greater. Maybe, I don't know if this quite follows what I'm saying and what you're asking, but it occurs to me as I speak that I grew up partly in Europe, and there were some great Catholic monasteries that I don't know how I saw them, how I knew about them. And there was something about, I went to one of them when I was 17, and I had this kind of peak experience going into this very, very old chapel. Everything got really peaceful and calm, and something kind of warmed in my heart. So there was something about, when I got older, that a memory of these experiences of being a feeling of wholeness or peacefulness in these kinds of places, said, that was actually a very high quality way of living. It was something very, really at home or connected in a deep way. And that became, the memory of that became kind of an inspiration to go further in my practice. But that place was actually kind of easy to be submerged. The busyness of life, the concerns that I had, the practical affairs of life. And to take the time to really listen deeply to yourself and find out what's most important. What are the deep inner sensibilities, sensitivities, deep inner calling, deep inner reference points that you have for what would really make you happy, really make you feel fulfilled, or really grow into something that feels really who you are. And then if meditation supports that, maybe then you're more motivated to meditate. And then it's easier then to meditate if you feel that meditation is satisfying. Wow, this is really good. Do I have to get up now? I'm standing for meditating for half an hour, and this is so sweet. You know, maybe I don't have to get up. Maybe I shouldn't get up. Or maybe it's not sweet, but you see that your daily life is better. And you see when you don't meditate, you suffer a little bit. So if you see there's a connection and supports you, it may be easier to be motivated. If you do this deep reflection about your intention, what's most important for you and how you want to live your life, what you want to attain, be, and you don't see any connection to meditation at all, leave it behind. Find something that does support, you know, what's really deep in you.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, my name is Bess, and I'm reading your book, The Buddha Before Buddha, or attempting to. And I've gotten stuck in the part where, I'm sorry if I totally misinterpret this, this is okay, where to find peace, it's important to not over-identify with a group, and in particular, religion. And I'm fine with that. I'm not a member of any particular religion. But I was thinking I'm really, really involved with a certain political party to the point where it feels like religion. And the thought of giving it up terrifies me. I feel like it would mean that I didn't care about the world. So I put the book away a couple weeks ago thinking, you know, I just, if that's the price of peace, I can't do it. So if you have anything you can, so I can pick up the book again, that would be great.
So I think the idea that this book is a translation of early teachings of the Buddha. The book's called The Buddha Before Buddhism. And he has kind of a radical message in there where the goal is to have some deep, very deep experience of peace, or really be at peace in this world in a profound way. But the way to do that is not to be attached to anything. And some of the common things that people can get attached to, at least in the time of the Buddha, was religion, was ideas of the truth, ideas of what's ultimate, particular experiences, which is the point, to have these experiences, you know, something. People are, and so he was saying the only way to have reliable peace is to let go. Let go of attachments. So chances are that you're not, if you're really attached to this political group and really attached to all this, then probably that's not a vehicle for you personally, to feel deeply at peace. And a corollary of that, probably not a way for you to feel really safe in this world. So you have to give up the attachment to it, which is a big challenge. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to walk away from the group. The causes that you're fighting for, concerned about, might be reasonable and appropriate and worthwhile to work for. And you might be more effective working with it if you're not attached. And you might be more effective and more convincing if you already feel safe in a deep way before you start the work. But if you're doing the work out of feeling of fear or out of anger or inadequacy or needing to have a connection, needing to have a sense of purpose from that kind of thing, maybe those reasons don't serve you really well. So you can have both. You can have peace and your group. But it might require you to do some real deep work. to really look at yourself really deeply, what's going on, and why you need the group, what you want the group for, what you're trying to accomplish, what motivates you, and it's really worthwhile to do that kind of deep inner reflection. And I wish more people who are involved in political groups did that. It's a gift to everyone else when someone really cleans up their act in a really deep way. Is that okay?
Thank you.
Good. Just a minute, Trudy. Well, go ahead.
I'm Jamie. I recently found out that someone who has written some things on spirituality that I liked and respected a lot has recently come out supporting some racist points of view. And I realize now I've been thinking about just about nothing else for about a day. I know that you've spoken before about, like, spiritual people that have qualities that are not so admirable, but I can't remember what you said about it. So I'm just wanting your point of view on that.
Yeah, this is an important topic, and I'm not sure I have all the wisdom to respond to you well. But sometimes we don't want to expect people to be saints. And maybe we can't expect that of anyone in all possible areas of their lives. And so sometimes the wise thing to do is to go be very discerning and identify what is most helpful, what is right for you, and don't give up your intelligence, don't give up your reflection and your thoughtfulness about things, but hear someone teach, for example, hear someone has something to say, and decide for yourself what is useful. And then take responsibility for that yourself. Don't give up your responsibility. Don't give up your, just don't blindly trust someone. And that way, if there's some aspect of that person that's not ethical or some aspect of that person which you don't agree with, it's okay with you because you're not depending on that person to provide everything. You're just an example. It's some information. It's something, some wisdom that you've discovered and made your own. So that's one answer. The other answer is that sometimes we do want to trust the people we're listening to, and we want to trust that they somehow represent what they're teaching. And so sometimes certain kinds of things they do that just doesn't seem to be aligned with what they're teaching. Maybe then this is not the most reliable person to learn this particular teaching from, because maybe it doesn't really add up in a full way. And so I think it's kind of a good teaching. But I think that I'll go somewhere else and see if someone else has a different variation of it that maybe does work for me. So how do we negotiate this? I don't know. And I'll give you one example for myself. And this is an example of when I was young and a new Zen student. And I'm not proud of this. I don't think necessarily it was a good, I don't know if I'd do that anymore. But at the time, it worked for me. So I wanted to go study with a particular Zen teacher, and I was, I was kind of part of the counterculture back in the 1970s, early 70s, and lived on communes and back to nature, living as simply as possible, creating as little damage on the environment as we could, and being really light, so that was kind of my whole ethos, my whole background for how I came to the Zen Center. And I wanted to study with this particular teacher. And one day I saw his car parked in the parking lot. And it was an Audi. And the license plate said 00 Zen. And I saw this and I think Audi. Because, Audi for me was like opulent. For this hippie, coming off the commune. I had, almost no money. And so I made a decision. I could see that. I said, in my way, I don't approve this person's lifestyle. but I could still learn Zen from this person. So I decided to stay. And that worked for me. I don't know if it was wise. But you know, but I made that separation. Eventually I separated from that teacher because the teacher's ethics became much bigger than just what kind of car he drove. But so anyway, so there's you know, you can make different choices. So I don't know what the issue is, you know, what the topic is, his concerns. But sometimes you can learn a lot from someone you don't agree with certain areas of their life or where they have shortcomings. Okay? Trudy.
Earlier, when you were answering Beth's question, excuse me, you mentioned the need to have a purpose in life. And that struck a chord with me because that's been very important to me throughout my life, to have a purpose and live by it. And yet I have a feeling that there can be an inordinate sense of attachment to having a purpose or that particular purpose. So I was wondering if you'd say a little more about that.
Yeah. Well, this is a very multifaceted topic, so I'll probably can't do it justice, but I'll try to say a few things. You know, to have some sense of meaning, purpose, direction, some activity that helps us feel fulfilled is a very important part of life, I think. Having a sense of autonomy and agency and willing to be able to do things in the world is very important, I think, for a sense of well-being. To have a sense of belonging. So that sometimes purpose and belonging are closely connected because you have a purpose you share with others, like a political group, and you feel like you belong. It's your tribe, your people, and feel like you're kind of moving in a nice direction. And it's a dangerous topic because people sometimes invest too much importance in it, or they set the standards too high. You know, they maybe growing up, their parents expected them to be doctors and lawyers, and so, but that wasn't the purpose that was going to suit them. And for them, maybe what worked for them is to maybe be, you know, a craftsperson of some kind and work with their hands and be a gardener. And that's what really, you know, their purpose and where they feel alive and feel like really meaningful. And so, you know, to be very careful with what we hear from our peers, from our family, from our society, what our purpose should be, and also what we're trying to fulfill. Sometimes a lot of ego can go into a sense of purpose. Yes, my purpose is to do, you know, whatever. It's because I just want a lot of praise. I want people to think that I'm a great, good person. And so there's conceit involved in that. So the idea is to part of the function of mindfulness is to be able to tease apart the different strands that come into play around it, so we really understand and simplify it so it's pure or simple or doesn't have the egotism as self-centeredness as or conceit that's kind of entangled with it. And then when you come to Buddhism, then Buddhism has its own kind of take on this kind of question. And Buddhism does provide a lot of sense of purpose or meaning. I think in a world of suffering, one of the great things we can do, one of the great motivations is to help have the world suffer less. And to be motivated by that is one of the, in Buddhism it's called a noble motivation. And then and when we really understand for ourselves the depths of suffering, the depth of freedom from suffering, then we know much more what's possible for the world around us and for others. And then to work to alleviate suffering from people in the world, that's a great thing. It's a great purpose and value. It doesn't have to come from any kind of calculation in the mind, but it comes from the heart. This is what the heart does. It responds to. And it's the heart that provides the meaning, not the ideas. So, but Buddhism also has this idea that so as we become freer of suffering, there's a place of deep peace and well-being that comes when a certain kind of, all kinds of normal mental activities begin to quiet down. And especially if you go into meditation, we get more and more of the quieting, and we discover a sense of well-being and peace that's not dependent on any activity of the mind, including the activity of the mind that needs purpose. And that's a radical thing to experience. There might still be, you might come out of that peace and invite back that purpose and live with that purpose that you had, but you know that your deep sense of peace and well-being and happiness is not dependent on the purpose anymore. That there's a deep sense of wholeness and well-being. So in Buddhist circles, sometimes they emphasize discovering, having no purpose. And sometimes the language is kind of strict, you know, cut that out, just stop it, there's no purpose here. Sometimes they'll say, in Zen, sometimes they'll say, there's no purpose. Why do we do Zen? No purpose. But to discover this place where the things get, we're so at home in this world that we don't have to do anything or accomplish anything, then actually gives a lot of strength to when we come back and want to live a life of purpose. It's kind of cleaner and purer to do it. But even more important, at least for some people, I don't know how it works differently for different people, different minds, different ways we work, is that to be able to shed or drop or let go of a lot of the agitation, a lot of the mental chatter, a lot of the emotional turmoil we have, and be really settled and quiet and peaceful inside, then sometimes something which is not the ego, something which is not the kind of calculated thoughts and ideas, it's not the received ideas we've gotten from our society, can well up. And there becomes kind of, the idea of a calling, the idea of a impulse that it wells up from inside, that this is what you want to do. And it could be a big surprise for some people, what wells up, this is what I want to do. And that sense of purpose then is not so much wouldn't be a sense of purpose that, or the source of the purpose is not an explanation. So for example, again for me, that when I decided to become a Zen priest, a Zen monk at some point, and I was living at a Zen monastery and a young man trying to figure out what to do with my life. And so I really got involved intensely at some point. I had to make a decision. I had to figure out what I was going to do with myself. So one of the options was to be ordained as a Zen monk and make that a life of myself for me. And so I was involved in this deep reflection one day. And there was a catalyst for the reflection. I was sitting, looking down at the river and just kind of, once again, kind of going in and thinking about it and being with this question, what should I do? And then suddenly, there was a sudden shift. I felt like a physical shift inside my body. And then I knew. And what I knew was I was going to be ordained as a Zen monk. And then I decided I should have a reason. And the reason came afterwards, after the knowing. And that also refers a little bit to your question, that it doesn't work for everyone this way and doesn't work all the time, but some of the biggest decisions in my life that I've made didn't come from a decision, but came from a knowing. But I had to, the conditions had to be in place for that knowing to arise. And one of the conditions is some deep abiding sense of well-being. So for you, I think you'll be forgiving if I don't say the right thing here. It's because we know each other. So, it's a little bit risky what I'm going to say, your age is not invisible. That when people reach a certain age, what gives purpose can be very different than what it's like when we're younger. And sometimes to really get quiet enough to hear a deeper calling, deeper movement, a deeper heart's wish, is actually more important the older we get. And the more important it is to shed a lot of the social concerns, a lot of the social messages, a lot of the kind of old identities and roles that we think are so important, so we can listen to something really, really deep. To have it, you know, it's good for any age at all. But, you know, in my, you know, it's now that I'm starting to get gray hair, wrinkles and stuff like that, I think it becomes more important as we get older. So I think that for you to ask the question is a wonderful thing. And I think it's a great thing for you to kind of plumb the depths of it. Okay? We have time for one more? Or we have 5 minutes. Yes, so.
Kristen, I've been working on trying to be a little bit more disciplined in my meditation. And so then it got worse. So I've been trying, and this has happened over the last little while, that I can't even sit for like a 45-minute session like this without my eyes opening 4 or 5 times, like without any conscious decision to do it. It just kind of happens. And sometimes, you know, there's a fair amount going on up there, but sometimes it's actually really useful information, but it comes in such a rush that it kind of jolts me out. And then sometimes it's like a memory or something like right. that, but it happens the same. So I've sort of been trying to count my breaths a little bit, but even that, I can't seem to sustain it very well.
So if I'm interpreting what you say accurately, it seems like maybe you're operating on the idea that meditation is a particular thing, your eyes closed and not moving. What if you just say that all that during that time, the eyes open and this jolt and these things, that's all part of the same meditation process. It's just it's just how it has to unfold for you at this time.
Oh. I didn't have that as an option.
Yeah, well then you have a problem, right? Then you have lots of problems. But if you just, once you sit down to meditate, rather than having some narrow idea of what it is so that you bump up against that and have problems, but why don't you just open up and just say, once I sit down, whatever happens is the meditation. And let me try to work with it as it is. Then all kinds of things can happen, but they don't have to be a problem then. And maybe you'll find your way that way.
Oh, that sounds nice. Could I just ask you a follow-up question
sure.
then, though? Because I sort of hear maybe people talking about being more concentrated is good, and I feel like when I keep doing this stuff, there's not going to be any concentration happening.
Well, that's probably right. But so what? you put yourself in another box? The concentration box, it has to be concentrated. I just gave you your freedom.
It's funny how I can't take it. Thank you.
Yeah, that would run the experiment and just be very permissive and just whatever happens is if it's okay, it's like part of the process. And then try to be mindful and engaged with what's happening. And don't fight it, don't judge it as being wrong and that you somehow missed the boat and you're supposed to be a certain way. Maybe this is exactly the way you're supposed to be. And the way for you is listening to what you described, my assumption would be that it's actually important things that are moving through you. They're unwinding, opening up. You know, you're processing things. And it's actually a very important part of the process. And it's easier to settle down and move through it if you make space for it than if you try to override it or be disciplined and kind of, you know, push that all aside. And also, it's a lot easier to love yourself if you have this openness to the experience. It's, you know, it's okay. Let's practice with how we are, not how you think you should be.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And if you want, you can, some, you know, in a few weeks, you can tell me how that goes. So I appreciated the questions, and I hope that was a nice evening to come here this way and not have the usual way of a talk. And so I thank you all, and I hope that your meditation or your non-meditation helps you connect to something deep inside that becomes the wellspring of your well-being and happiness and purpose.